Radio City, once again, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you, hanging out, doing our thing. And once again, Rob, we find ourselves, even though we've recorded, I don't know how many of these in the last 4 or 5 days, we've just got way too much to go over. It's a bounty of riches for those of us who just talk about what's going on in the world, huh?
Well, the beautiful thing about what we do is that we're unfettered by it.
Right.
That makes it a lot easier because we're talking about things that people can't talk about because they're censored or time constricted or just plain afraid to talk about it the way it needs to be talked about.
Yeah, and I guess it's even better that I don't work for CBS anymore because now I can talk about what a shit Charlie Rose is. I mean, it's gotten so crazy, and it's funny because with Charlie Rose being the latest, and this just happened over the last 24 hours or so, to be accused of ongoing sexual harassment and sexual misconduct, it's gotten to the point now where, again, it's kind of that weird space where Kevin Spacey was, because with Charlie Rose, there's nobody who wants this to be true, and yet, can we even be surprised? I mean, is there any name that's still on the list of people that would surprise you if you found out that they were grabbing ass all the time?
No.
Yeah, right? There just isn't anybody.
I mean, and again, you know, it goes back to what you and I have talked about and is now becoming a recurring theme. Not meant in a funny / humorous or worse sarcastic manner. The fact that we're now so used to this kind of thing.
Yep.
And is it jadedness? Is it a natural progression into that state of being? Is it that we're not, it's like hearing about another shooting every week. We're that desensitized? You know, and I put that as a question because this is what it's come down to. And I wish we didn't have to talk about these things, but we do. They need to be brought up. Now, with Charlie Rose, you know, being the stoic, you know, very serious, very cerebral, you know, that kind of a presence in news at a time when news is about as worth anything as putting into a cat box to line it. I find myself at an absolute loss. I mean, look, I can't even say it correctly. I can't even articulate the disgust I have for this whole thing. And really, if I was being truthful, I wish it weren't so from the side of the left. And I don't want to go into a political dissertation about it, not a tirade, but at the same time, my undying contempt of what has become the left, it's wholly deserved. So I'm in that kind of conundrum about it. You know, I would rather it be just the, you know, the Roy Moores of the world and Donald Trump having to deal with this kind of thing. And it's every piece of garbage, the predictable piece of garbage that's, you know, the bastions of morality, the Bible thumpers, the you know, the anti-gay, the ones that get caught with their pants down for being the biggest hypocrites of all.
Right.
But no, at the same time, you've got the social justice warriors and those who help them to wave their flags getting caught out. So there is, I guess, an even-handed distribution of the, quote, wealth.
Right. And yeah, and with Charlie Rose, CBS fired him and PBS fired him, and what happened very quickly, and part of it is because even though he gave a kind of half-hearted attempt at, well, I don't think all of these stories are accurate, it was still, I mean, he had no problem admitting that, yeah, he is engaged in some of this behavior, and he's just gone. So here's the real question. You look at what's going on with Roy Moore right now, and you have Donald Trump, who actually stood up and defended him today and said, well, he really denied it, and then he forcefully denied it, as though that makes a damn bit of difference, as though a guy who was accused of sexual assault on a 14-year-old would ever be in a position where he'd go, yeah, that was me. So is it the wrong thing to do when you're accused of this kind of thing, even if you did it, even if you're Charlie Rose or you're the hell's his name now? I can't even think. Al Franken or whomever, is it the wrong thing for them to deal with it the way they are, to be human and say, yeah, I fucked up and I shouldn't have done that. And I'm going to try not to do that anymore, because those are the guys who are paying for it the most, while Roy Moore still has half the people in Alabama supporting him. And he's got the president of the United States who's ready to go to battle again and say, no, 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 it's all lies. It's all bullshit. Even though anybody with half a brain knows Roy Moore did shit he shouldn't have done.
It's a double-edged sword. You know, the fact is, well, first of all, you bring up a really good point. They're doing the quote right thing of sorts by semi-admitting it, but it's never a straightforward admittance. It's like right. You just stated, Charlie Rose does they do it the half-assed way. You know, I apologize for inappropriate behavior, but.
Right.
How about just saying, yes, I did it. And that's it. You leave it at that one sentence. I think that says everything. Sometimes less is more.
Right. But in Roy Moore's case, he's probably going to win. If they keep this shit up, I mean, you look at what happened during the 2016 election, and as much as we don't want to go back there, it's almost exactly the same series of events. So you have Donald Trump, who was accused of all kinds of wrongdoing, and you had the Access Hollywood tape that dropped a month exactly before the election. And what happened? He turned the thing around, he went back to war, and he won. So now in this case, the Roy Moore stuff all drops a month before the special election, and now the fight begins, and now the rampant defense begins, and now Roy Moore himself and all of his surrogates are out there on the attack right now. And if it happens again, and if he wins this thing again, I am going to lose what little faith I have left in our electoral system.
Well, unfortunately, you're going to lose it because, as you have quite rightly stated before, for whatever purpose, for whatever reason, for whatever belief system, because I don't want to call it insanity, even though it really is, but irrationality the people of Alabama seem to have, this mental vapor lock that says it's okay for Roy Moore. He's above all of this. And they're going to elect him anyway.
Right.
I mean, it's just we have to, you know, be prepared for the fact that, well, he's not a Democrat is going to be the rallying battle cry. And that's what's going to make them go to the polls and vote for him. Now, maybe, just maybe, there may be, and I'm really stretching this, some kind of last minute push by women who would not accept what Roy Moore has done and continues to defend himself against, and vote against him. So maybe there will be a surge of unexpected voters. That's all you can, quote, hope for.
Yeah, man, and I hope so. I really do. I mean, I would like not to think that Alabama is the same backwater, backwoods, seething cauldron of idiocy that it's been portrayed in the news. And if they elect this guy, I will have no choice but to believe that that's exactly what it is.
I'm really sorry to say, but I think it is going to be. I mean, look, if I don't even remember, at this point, he's become a minor character. I don't remember the name of his opponent. But
yeah,
it also harkens back to something that you said a few weeks ago, when the elections were held, and you know the Democrats are all running around and patting themselves on the back. Well, how about you get to work?
Right,
get your shit together and get to work. Look, we just reelected a Democratic mayor here in New York, and today he admits that he knew that the housing authority had lied about lead paint being problematic still in low-income housing. You know, this is the mayor that pandered, and I do mean pandered, to the black community of New York.
And it worked.
He sucked up to them more than anything. And he got reelected, and he's fucked them.
Yeah, right.
He's also the same mayor who, of course, has been nothing less than disgraceful in his attitude and approach and public demeaning of the New York City Police Department. You know, people want to be conned.
Yeah.
They do.
And that's a sad reality, but it seems to be a reality because, I mean, even while all of this is going on, it behooves Donald Trump to do exactly what he's doing. To go to war and to fight for Roy Moore, because if Roy Moore wins, he keeps the Senate seat, and that's the obvious piece of it. But there's another piece of it as well, because this has been, even though it hasn't been front and center in the news, because we've all been following the latest sexual harasser to get popped, this has been an absolutely horrifyingly bad week for the Trump administration in terms of the Russia investigation. But nobody's watching. And the more Donald Trump can shove that aside by having people go, ooh, should he support Roy Moore or should he not support Roy Moore? The better it is for him, because nobody's watching what's going on as Jeff Sessions continues to lie his ass off in front of the body that he used to be, a part of, and maybe again.
The funny thing is that, and again, taken with the enormous grain of salt that I think you and I certainly do, now, Morning Joe is the only place where they kind of made that the clarion call. Don't forget, folks, he's involving himself here because he doesn't want to talk about the Russia investigation.
Right.
You know, he has, it's a very conscious thing, and yet they're the only one. I don't know about the rest of MSNBC simply because I don't have the patience, frankly, to watch any of them, because I think they're as repugnant as foxes. They're no different. They're interchangeable. But because my morning choices now are so limited, you know, I do watch that little tiny bit of Morning Joe. And as insufferable as that show has become, they are doing what is right by continually mentioning, let's not forget Russia.
Right. Yeah. Why he's doing this. And by the way, now your morning choices are even more limited because Charlie Rose is gone. So you don't even have that anymore. Yeah. And what you just have to hope is that people are paying enough attention to continue to keep the pressure on, because without a big event like Manafort getting arrested and all of that, it's harder for people to maintain that kind of attention level because there's just so much else out there to distract them.
Well, for God's sakes, look at how quickly they forget about all these mass shootings that have happened in the span of a month.
Right. Yeah, and it's as though, I mean, the last one happened a week and a half ago, and it's as though it didn't. You know, it was never even a part of the consciousness. It's just...
Well, I mean, we had that the terrorist attack in New York 3 weeks ago, and that already faded away.
Right. Speaking of terror attacks, there's another Donald Trump thing. Not to spend too much time banging on him, but really labeling North Korea a state sponsor of terrorism. What was the North Korean sponsored terror attack again? Yeah, right.
I mean, did somebody barf on Wee Jong Boo?
Yeah, it just, I mean, it's so completely senseless. And yet this shit goes by and people go, oh yeah, as though state sponsor of terrorism is just a synonym for bad.
Real bad.
You real bad hombres.
Keep it to it, man.
Maga. Sorry. Yeah, exactly. So that being said, there are some other things going on, and I had a conversation today with a guy, the same author, by the way, who did Hammer of the Gods, which was the book about Led Zeppelin from so many years ago that broke the story about the Red Snapper and all of the other craziness that was going on while that band was a going concern. He's got a new unauthorized biography out about Stevie Nicks, and the good part about the book is that, and it's called Gold Dust Woman, the good part about the book is that it's not just Stevie. It certainly centers around her, but it tells the stories about Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and about Prince and about everything that was going on with Fleetwood Mac. The book is worth the read, but it's such an interesting thing. I never really thought of myself as being I like Stevie Nicks' voice, and I like some of her music, but I never thought of myself as being the kind of person that would sit down and read a book about her. And yet, you know, I guess it's, the well has not run dry as far as writing this kind of biography of rock and roll, and it just shows how many really interesting stories there are out there, whether or not you're a fan of the subject of the thing.
Well, you bring up a really great point because, you know, you never considered yourself enough of a fan. You know, when I went to see Fleetwood Mac, I think it was 2 years ago, mm-hmm. Maybe 3 years at this point, to be honest with you. I can't remember because I saw so many shows within that time frame. When I saw Fleetwood Mac, you know, I was in that half mindset of the 12-year-old me who hated them because rumors was everywhere so much so often that you know, you were ready to just start screaming at the top of your lungs if you heard Dreams One More Time come on the radio.
Right.
Because really, I mean, you couldn't escape it. But I also had the same approach with the Eagles for a long time, considering I loved the singles up until Hotel California. Then it was just all out war.
Right.
Now, you know, when I saw Fleetwood Mac, it really changed my mind dramatically because of just the sheer greatness of their live performance. Now you're talking about people who are in their 60s and early 70s who still managed to get up there and play with such a fire and passion and abandon. And I don't think we really need to go into what a remarkable guitar player Lindsey Buckingham truly is.
Oh, I mean, no doubt.
When they did Big Love, my mouth dropped open. I mean, he was just so unreal. To watch him do that, I think he's one of the greatest guitarists I've ever watched.
Oh yeah, and I mean the writing of that music, it's amazing. When you try and play that stuff and you try and break your fingers doing all of those amazing things that Lindsey Buckingham does, it's not the kind of thing you can pick up easily. I will warn you, though, if you read this book, he does come off as something of a snot in it. He's not a sympathetic character.
I was given to understand. What I was about to say is, then I saw Stevie last year.
Yeah.
When she headlined on her Greatest Hits tour. And she was magnificent.
Yep.
She gave 2 hours and wanted to keep going. That's right. How much fun she was having. So it shows that she still has the energy, the excitement, and the passion. And she certainly fed off the audience. And it was great. And she gave you every hit from both, you know, the solo albums and from Fleetwood Mac. So I would sit down and read the book. I've come to consider myself a fan because I actually went out and picked up a copy of Belladonna. Simply
yeah.
Because it had stopped dragging my heart around. And it's got Edge of 17.
Right.
And I was given to understand, actually, I had this conversation on Saturday when we were out doing the Thanksgiving Day shop. We were talking, I think it was one of their tracks came on the radio, and my lovely wife Liz said to me, you know, Lindsey Buckingham was a real fuckhead. He comes up as really abusive.
Yeah.
He was physically abusive to her, and I just looked at her and I said, at this point, unfortunately, does that shock you? She said, no, unfortunately, it doesn't.
Yeah.
I do know this much. I remember reading a little snippet of something, and Stevie Nicks was once asked, and I don't know if they addressed this in the book, but she was asked, well, who is the great love of your life? And without missing a beat and blinking an eye, she said, Joe Walsh.
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, good for you, Joe. You know? Stevie, you know what? Stevie may be in her 60s, but she's still adorable.
Oh, yeah, she is.
Adorable.
And the voice is still right there, too. So
I'll tell you something. Live, that voice is magnificent.
Yep.
That voice is – that's something special.
Yeah, we saw that same tour about – it was just before Petty died because she talked about Prince in the past tense, but she was still talking about Tom in the present. And you're right. I mean, she was just – it was well worth every dime that we spent to go to that show. We'd have done it again in a heartbeat. But that's out there, and it's not the only one, and it's not always done terribly well. Now, Stephen Davis, who wrote that book, knows what he's doing. But as much as, you know, again, we're mining every little bit of the history of rock and roll, you ran across a documentary that didn't quite live up to the advance billing. What's the story with Mick Ronson?
Well, you know, Mick Ronson has been lauded as being this guitar hero, and rightly so. I mean, he was just a phenomenal guitar player because he was one of the ones that played with a sense of flash and fire, but it was less is more. He wasn't the Jimmy Page type guitarist. Rather, he was a bit more minimal. You know, he was great with giving sound and shape and really fueling the body of a song to make it sound the way you know the song and love the songs to be, you know.
To draw the parallel back again, much more like Waddy Wachtel.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, You know, Mick Ronson was working at that time exclusively with David Bowie, who is a very measured, detailed, meticulous, and, you know, completely focused artist. And I think he was kept, Ronson was kept within a certain frame of being. You know, he couldn't really, and I don't think he would have cut loose. I don't think that was his persona either, to be flashier. But what he played and the way he constructed and the sound that he got gave Bowie those songs, and those songs have a life that live on because you know them and you remember them. You know, you hear that opening of Suffragette City,
yeah,
or Ziggy Stardust, or the riff to Rebel Rebel, or, you know, any of the, or even, you know, the very, very simple riff of Man Who Sold the World. Mick Ronson was, for all intents and purposes, a true guitar hero. The thing about this documentary called Beside Bowie is, first and foremost, it's too much Bowie. It's just too much. It comes off more of, and by the way, you know, Mick Ronson. He's almost, to me, he was more of an afterthought in the overall framework of the story. Now, Mick Ronson was a very low-key and humble guy. He didn't really play the role of rock star, rock god, whatever. And there may not have been enough material to truly warrant and justify a documentary. That could be it. The testimonials were certainly very warm and very lovely and embracing. You know, not a bad word could have been said about the man. But I just felt like he became, you know, the co-star. It was Bowie in the lead and Ronson is the co-star. And that kind of put me off of it.
Yeah, if you're going to do a Bowie documentary, do that.
You know, what I did enjoy seeing, if there's, you know, anything, is the fact that there's a lot of footage from TV appearances when they were at the height of the whole, you know, glam rock mania that was never seen here, obviously, because glam rock wasn't a going fashion or commodity. You know, I mean, for Americans, certainly for me as a kid, you know, in that period when, you know, Bowie and of course Bolan and Roxy Music were ruling the charts over in England and bands we've never heard of over here, you know, the closest we came was Elton John and Queen.
Right.
But they had pop hits going on well past, you know, the expiration date of glam rock. So, but overall, it was an okay documentary. I will put it to you this way. If you're a diehard fan, you're going to enjoy this.
Okay.
I mean, like I said, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that I felt it was too much of Bowie. And I've got to be honest, there were a couple of people in there that you didn't need as much of them as was left in.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to pick those people out the minute you hear them start to speak. Let's put it this way. It wasn't as bad as that awful documentary on The Replacements, in which The Replacements aren't even in it.
Right.
and even more insulting, that horrific quote-unquote documentary on The Damned. That's still unpardonable and unforgivable how that was handled.
Right.
Shameful waste.
Yeah.
So, you know, for the fans of Bowie and Ronson, I mean, because one doesn't go without the other, really, when you get down to it.
I have the one thing to kind of tease, and I hesitate to do this because it's been a coming attraction for probably the better part of 20 years. But a good friend of mine is working on a documentary, and I'm told that it's done to the extent that it may soon be ready for distribution. I don't know what channel that's going to take, if any, but my buddy Art Holliday has been working on a documentary of Johnny Johnson for forever. And, it looks like if the work put in pays off on this thing, and for anybody who doesn't know, Johnny Johnson was the author and the driving force behind Chuck Berry, early on, and was his keyboard player, his piano player. It looks like it's going to be an amazing piece of work. So all I can tell you is when there's more news on that, I'll have more news for you on that, but it's one to keep an ear out for. And before we leave music entirely, while we're continuing to mine the back catalogs, there's more back catalog mining going on right now with Husker Du, but this time it's not a documentary, it's not a book, it's actual more music. What's out there?
Well, it's this wonderful box set from the Numero group called Savage Young Du. And this is music that has never been heard. Well, it includes music that has never been heard. We're talking about the first recordings in a studio by Husker Du between 1979 and 1981. The sound is amazing because the sources were taken a lot from cassettes.
Wow.
Okay. The other important thing is that there's an alternate version of Metal Circus on here, which of course was released on SST in 1983. And there is a remastered, remixed Everything Falls Apart, which was their first technical album, even though it was released on at the speed of 45 RPM mm-hmm. as a 12-inch, on their own Reflex label. Rhino put it out very briefly in the late 80s, early 90s, as Everything Falls Apart and More, and included the original Reflex singles, which are, of course, Statues, Back with Amusement, and although technically this isn't a Reflex single, In a Free Land was put out by New Alliance, Mike Watt and Dee Boone of the Minutemen. But they're all on here. They're all on here, and they sound amazing. And you hear songs that have never been heard that were basically Husker Du's thing was as they would play their way through sets and come up with new songs, they would evaluate and jettison songs. So songs like Uncle Ron and Sex Dolls and Do the Bee, Let's Go Die, you know, some of them made it as far as Land Speed Record, which was, frankly, an incoherent album because it's loud, blink and you missed it fast, and live. So you can't really tell what the quote-unquote songs sound like. The fact is, though, this is a monumentally important document of Husker Du. And like we've said before, it's the first sign that the Husker Du estate is on the same page together, and they're trying to move themselves into a position where you'll be able to hear the songs the way they should be heard. I hope, really, that Bob Mould, Grant Hart's estate, and Greg Norton are able to regain all the masters, including the Warner Brothers masters, and go in and remix those records. Yeah. You know, whichever ones that I think they might find the most value in remixing. I would certainly want to see Zen Arcade remixed, Flip Your Wig remixed, because I find it to be such a powerful album, very few people do. Warehouse Songs and Stories could really benefit from a remix. You know, Candy Apple Gray wasn't that strong of an album. That might be possibly their weakest next to Land Speed Record. I can't count because, like I said, it's just it is what it is. Mm-hmm. But you know, that if you remixed it, you would remix it only on the premise that songs like Sorry Somehow and Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely would definitely benefit the most, since they were the two hits from that record. But all in all, if you're a fan of Husker Du, this is such a welcome treasure, this Savage Young Du box set.
Excellent.
And hopefully the catalog will somehow reappear. Not in the hands of SST. You know, if they can pry away Metal Circus, Zen Arcade, New Day Rising, and Flip Your Wig, it would benefit Husker Du enormously, and it would benefit us as fans to hear them in the hands of a better and more caring record label who would know how to make these albums sound right.
Cool. Well, you've just given me my idea for our In Our Head segment this week, too, so we'll get to that in a little while. Before we do, though, there are some things to go over as far as the sad goodbyes and fond farewells column, because, again, there's way too many of them this week. And
we suddenly, in the last 72 hours, have had, you know, no less than three deaths, and David Cassidy is still fighting.
Right.
I will, you know, hope for the best for him.
Indeed.
It doesn't feel good, but, you know, I think everybody's hoping for the best because he seems like such a genuinely nice person, and he's always been very, very good and very caring about his fans. But, I mean, we lost two major actors that you know, didn't even make news headlines, which I find appalling. You know, the incomparable Della Reese, who's an amazing singer and actor. You know, if you don't remember her, for our age bracket, of course, we all remember her from being on Chico and the Man, but she spent a lot of years later on that awful Touched by an Angel.
That's all I keep hearing this week is she was on Touched by an Angel, and I keep wanting to strangle people.
Well, they're idiots, and they don't know, because people don't know history.
Right.
And they don't know, you know, who or what or when. And Earl Hyman, who, you know, he had such a long history in films and in theater. You know, he was one of those character actors who's like, I know him, but what's his name? Earl Hyman, for Christ's sakes. Most people will remember him as playing the father to Bill Cosby's Cliff Huxtable on The Cosby Show.
Right, right.
That's how you'll remember him. You'll know him the moment you think about him. You'll immediately picture him. But neither one of them got their due in the press, and I find that to be shameful. And the one that I was kind of remiss to or loath to bring up was Charles Manson finally died. Well, shit. Too little, too late.
Okay, but here's, you know? Here's the
he
thing about
Manson. Executed.
Yeah, well, right, and he was supposed to be if it hadn't been for the moratorium. But here's the thing about Manson dying, and it has nothing to do with some kind of weird misplaced nostalgia about him. But for the longest time, he represented our national boogeyman. He was more of a symbol. I mean, by the time I came along, the Manson family murders had already happened. He was already in prison. He was going to be there forever. So when he came into the consciousness, he was always the fable. He was the thing that went bump in the night. As I understand it, before him, it was Eddie Gein, the butcher of Plainfield, Wisconsin. And there's a hell of a story if you want to read a nice bedtime tale.
But before him, Richard Speck.
Right. And so, because we grew up in an era that had got, you know, was bookended by Manson on one end and went through Ted Bundy and got to, Jeffrey Dahmer on the other end. It's a weird position to be in now. Those guys are all gone, and I don't know that they've been replaced by anybody. I mean, who is
dead?
Oh, which?
Ted Bundy? Is
he dead? 1989. Yeah, they executed him in Florida in 1989.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. Good. I mean, I remember, actually, I was in Florida, and it was around this time, actually, in 94, that we were in the car. And we heard that Jeffrey Dahmer had been beaten to death in prison.
Right, right. And so, yeah, with all of that, I don't know that there is a living embodiment of the worst human being in America anymore. It's weird to say that, but it's like we don't have one.
Okay, well, question. John Wayne Gacy, is he still alive?
Gacy's dead. Gacy's okay. Been dead for a while.
The answer to that question at this moment would be Donald Trump.
How could I forget? Yeah, unfortunately, sad but true. Yeah, the worst person in America lives in the White House. Ugh.
I mean, he's a guy I always wished was dead. I'm sorry to say, you know, he's... But again, that's coming from the New Yorker, you know?
Right.
The guy who's had to live with this fucking asshole hanging over our heads for the last 30-plus years, you know? And he's our goddamn president.
Right. Yeah, and there's one other thing to make mention of, even though he is still very much alive, but we had a guy who, again, is not a name that probably rolls off of every tongue, but Scott McCoy is a songwriter and a guy who's been there with a bunch of different bands and has contributed his talents, both, you know, behind the keyboard with a guitar and is a songwriter for I don't know how many different bands. He had a stroke this week. Talk a little bit about what he's done.
Let's start with the fact that he was in a very well-loved, albeit cult band, Young Fresh Fellows.
Yeah.
Right. The band that was notorious for shaving off their eyebrows, if I'm not mistaken. one of their first claims to fame.
They were the first ones to do it. They were the only ones to do it. But, you know,
they were kind of a really good, almost... They were what the Replacements could have been.
Yeah.
I always thought, musically speaking. But I think most people would know Scott McCoy from having been one of the supplemental musicians with REM during the post-Bill Berry era.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, Scott McCoy maintained his relationship with Peter Buck, and they had bands like The Minus Five.
Like those two ships that blew up in the night. I
Venus 3, Robin Hitchcock and the Venus 3, The Baseball Project, which evolved into this latest band, Filthy Friends. And he was just on tour with Alejandro Escovedo when this stroke occurred. And you want to talk about a guy that is so beloved by so many and such a good guy, you know, just a good soul. And you want him to pull through this. You know, you want him to get the best possible medical care and to be able to be rehabbed so that he's hopefully at 100% and soon, because he's the kind of musician that we still need out there, because he's a fairly young guy, you know. He's not, and he's not some, you know, debauched, you know.
Right.
Old muso that, you know, we want him to get well. So it's just really a shout out of love and appreciation and a get well soon. But, you know, there is one other thing that I wanted to bring up because, well, frankly, when we did it on the original version of 39, because this is 39 Smooth, redo.
Yeah.
You want to talk about mining the cachet, although this is really well worth it. There's a new CD box set out by The Who. Now, the key thing about this is that we talked about the original versions of this, which was the single boxes that came out over the span of 2015 and 2016.
On vinyl, right, yeah.
Right, and it was vinyl only, and it was the original singles redone on the labels they'd originally come out on. So it was there was the Brunswick box, there was the Reaction box, there was the Track box, and there was the Polydor box. Now finally they're all collected on a 5 CD set, sorry. And believe me when I say it's worth it. Even if you're like me and you have to have, you know, look, this is the only place that you're going to get both versions of Circles, also known as Instant Party. I've told that story before because it's really complicated, but both versions of Circles that you couldn't get the second version on CD. This is the first time you're going to get Waltz for a Pig, which is really not The Who, but The Who Orchestra, which is really the Graham Bond Organization, and the song was written by Ginger Baker. This was the flip side of Substitute, never on CD before. You will finally have good sounding versions of both The Last Time and Under My Thumb, which were, again, Blink and You Missed It. It appeared on Two's Missing, Long Out of Print. Okay. Missing in Action, since Magic Bus, the album Magic Bus, went out of print, was the John Entwistle track, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
Which, on this version, is a previously unheard version. It's longer, has a different, you know, a full ending instead of the very short, sloppy fade out that was on the old Decca copies. The bottom line is this: from On the Face all the way through to I'm Free, it's worth the price of admission.
Excellent.
And it's done really nicely, nice looking box. You've got to get it. If you're just beginning to feel around for The Who, all I have to say is this: you put on My Generation, and it still sounds as unbelievably vital, exciting, exhilarating. That's a musical orgasm, and especially when you're young, it's a life. That's one of the 5 life changers of somebody who's getting into music. It sounds as great and as powerful and overwhelming now as it did then. I first heard it when I was all of 12, 13, and it's never left my bloodstream.
Good. So. Good. All right. So more good stuff from The Who out there. And we've got a couple other things to hit before we get to the In Our Head segment. And it's a good thing, because I frankly just don't have the money to spend anyway. But it's a good thing that I live as far away now as I do from the teams that I grew up with, because I would still be sitting there, you know, trying to figure out whether I was going to spend the money for Bills and Sabres tickets. And they're so bloody awful right now, both of them. And well, yet,
question: what was the final score on Sunday?
I don't even remember. I didn't stick around. I left a Bills game for the first time before the ending. I left a Bills game since the 1993 AFC wild card game that the Bills ended up coming back and winning 41-38 over the Oilers. I turned it off. I just couldn't do it anymore.
Well, you know how I won on Sunday? It was a bye week.
Yeah, that's right. They didn't lose. But you pulled the trigger on Mets tickets.
I did. I didn't get the same field level seats that I'd gotten in 2015, but I still got seats for opening day. And listen, you can't do that very easily anymore, because I started trying to get my tickets when, quote, individual game tickets went on sale.
Yeah.
The day of sales at 10 o'clock a.m., and they were ready. I had, unfortunately, to go through fucking StubHub again. But I got them. It's not the same seats, but it'll still be a great moment. It's the Mets and the Cardinals this time on opening day, March 29th.
All right.
So I got my tickets. I'm good to go. I refuse to buy Rangers tickets. You know, unless somebody gifts them to me, fuck them. I'm not paying to see them. Until you get rid of Henrik Lundqvist and Rick Nash and Mark Stahl, I'm not going to a goddamn Ranger game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want to have any more conversations with so-called Rangers fans. If you're a real fan of a team, you'll be able to pick out what the problem is. And the problem is the same problem that they've had, except now exponentially worse because they're all older. Rick Nash as a trade has been a bust. He's invisible in the playoffs. Forget it. Nice guy, I don't give a fuck. Mark Stahl, I swear to God, every time a goal goes or the puck goes past Henrik Lundqvist, Mark Stahl is falling somewhere around the neck. Yeah. The guy just does not know how to defend. He's always there when a bad goal is given up. And no worse was in that horrific game in the playoffs against the Ottawa Senators, where the Rangers were leading by 2 goals, and Stahl collapsed twice in front of the net and took down Lundqvist with him, and that's the game where they blew it in overtime.
Yep.
Having said that, Henrik Lundqvist is a shitty goaltender. He has deteriorated to the point where I watched the game last week where it was 1-0 going very late into the second, and I'm not kidding. He had all the time in the world to just very simply close his legs. He let a trickling puck go through, didn't even look. Didn't think to check to see that this slow-rolling puck was going between his legs, and it rolled right past him into the next tie in the game. And that turned out to be a fucking 5-2 romp.
Yeah, and it's unforgivable when stuff like that happens. And you see it happening, you know that the guy is so far past his prime that there's no coming back from that. So, sad to say, but I've been there, and I've watched my teams do it before, so I'm getting ready to watch them do it again.
My question to you is this: what are you doing for Thanksgiving? Because this is being recorded pre-Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving is my personal favorite holiday of all, because there's no agenda, there's no gifts to be given, there's no religious connotation. It's just a wonderful, magnificent day for family and friends, the people that you care about the most, to just gather together, eat great food, and truly just be thankful that we're together and that we're still here.
And that's exactly what we're doing. Most of our extended families, both of us, are in other states. So we're going to just sit around with the kids, and we're going to have great food. I think both of the kids are going to end up working on Thursday evening, which is weird enough. But
that's an American.
I understand. But they've got to keep their gig. And so, we're just going to sit and watch football and not leave the house. And no, I'm not going anywhere on Black Friday either. Have no interest in that whatsoever. So, we're just going to hang. And whoever wants to come over can come over,
That's the same way we are. And, it's funny for me, the anticipation is always leading up to it's the Saturday before Thanksgiving, because we do our annual shop at Trader Joe's.
Yep.
Because Trader Joe's, and this is not a plug, this is just a fact. You go to Trader Joe's and you get everything for Thanksgiving in one shot. Now, we have 4 people total for this our dinner this Thanksgiving. And like we have for the last 2 or 3, and you can feed 4 people a full Thanksgiving dinner, everything fresh, cooked, fresh homemade, the whole thing, for roughly $150. And you're talking about the turkey, a big turkey, the fresh vegetables, the pies are remarkable. This year, oddly enough, they cut down their bakery table so that it's only pecan pies and pumpkin pies. Now, usually we don't get pumpkin because nobody really likes it. They always have this wonderful pumpkin spice cake, but they don't have it this year. They've only got those 2 kinds of pies and apple pie. So we got 2 pecan and a pumpkin, but they also snuck in there a chocolate pecan pie, which we already dispensed with. That wasn't gonna survive Saturday afternoon after we got home. But I'm telling you get everything at Trader Joe's in one go. We got there on Saturday morning, and if you've shopped at Trader Joe's, you know the drill is that, A, it gets packed really quickly, and B, if they sell out of something, you can't get it until the next day. You know, that's it. They have to restock. We were in there at 10:05 and already in the car at 10:45 because my wife and I split the list. My mission was, number one, get the cranberry orange relish. I didn't waste time looking for it. I just went to the first person I could find, asked them, they laughed, they took me over to it, I'm done. Walk over and get the turkey, forget it. It's all gravy from there.
Excellent. Well, yeah, we're lucky enough to live in a town that has an actual meat market, a family-owned, family-run meat market. And they, because none of us is a big fan of dark meat, we get extra lucky because they sell turkey legs. And I always wondered, when they sell turkey legs, what do they do with the rest of the turkey? And the answer is, they sell them to people like us. So we got nothing but white meat. We got a turkey breast, and it's still on the bone and the whole thing. You roast it just the way you normally would, and it's great.
As we speak, and as we're recording this, my wife is in the kitchen already starting the prep work for the stuffing. Because, and this is the beauty of it. I mean, you know, you get the 3 loaves of bread.
Yep.
And she gets potato bread, she gets Canadian white and multigrain. Lets it sit out for about a day or two to get stale, and then she starts the prep work with it. And since it's Tuesday night, all we'll have to do when we get home from work tomorrow is she'll whack that in the oven for the first round of light baking. So that way Thursday morning, stick it up the turkey's ass and let it go from there.
I'll take care of her. Excellent.
Yeah, great. So,
well, good deal. I hope that everything is as wonderful as it sounds like, and we'll be over about 8. So,
well, come a little earlier because, you know, look, we got 2 pecan pies.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
We're still later, so come earlier.
It's a lot to dispense with. And as we get to the In Our Head segment, as I say, you inspired something in me while we were talking a little bit earlier about Husker Du and the fact that you get to hear these songs with this new box set as they evolve. And it tripped a trigger in me because I love it when an artist, well, I usually love it, and there's some times that are better than others, when an artist goes back and revisits something from his previous catalog and monkeys with it and has a little bit of fun with it. And I will say right here at the outset, because it's probably the most famous example, and it kicked off that whole Unplugged series on MTV, that the version of Layla, the Unplugged version that Eric Clapton did, I never liked much. I mean, the original is so good, and the remake was just sort of bland and laid there. But there are some times when it's done really well, and if you get the Steve Miller 30th anniversary edition of Fly Like an Eagle, the album, he does a version of Take the Money and Run on there that's done in the style of the Joker. And it's, I think on the album, it's called Take the Joker and Run. And you know what? It's awesome. It sounds so good and it works perfectly.
Headed down to Old El Paso. That's where they ran into a castle. Billy Joe shot a man while robbing his castle. Bobby Sue took the money and run, run, run. You know what to do. Run, run, run. Where you going to?
And you can tell that he was just sitting around in the studio one day and went, you know what we ought to do? We ought to just kind of mash these two together and see what happens. And it won't supplant the original, but it's so good that I'm glad he went ahead and did it, because we get that, you know, that additional version of a really good song to begin with. And it's the same reason why I was so in love with the Warren Zevon Preludes album, that it was the other end of the spectrum. It was how the songs evolved into what they ended up being. So with that in mind, what are those songs for you that you loved anyway, and then you found out that the same person had done an alternate version of it, and you thought, you know what, that was worth the price of admission?
Cool Blue Halo by Richard Barone is the one that I'm thinking of the most, because A, that was the forerunner to the whole Unplugged movement, but also because on there, when that record came out, there are, quote, some songs by the Bongos, most notably the Bulrushes, which is almost like my second calling card, because I've done the song so many times for so many years. but it's been reshaped and retooled to be much more lower voltage.
Yeah.
Right? Beautiful the way he does it. And Numbers with Wings, which is far more emotionally heart-wrenching, really.
Time flies, the hands on the hourglass. Getting born, then watching the seasons pass. And on cold nights, my soul is like anyone's.
What I find fascinating about that record, let me see if I can work my way into this without getting too off the beaten path. That record was my introduction to songs like I Belong to Me and Tangled in Your Web, which when you hear these are just two of the most stunning things you'll ever hear. Now, these are live, you know, live performances. It wasn't until 2013 when, after all those years, Richard and the other Bongos finally released the long missing album Phantom Train. And I never knew that those two songs were in fact recorded by the Bongos for this album. Okay?
Yeah.
So now I'm hearing the original version. I'm going, it goes backwards instead, because the Phantom Train / band versions were recorded 2 years before Cool Blue Halo was recorded. Having said that, while I really love the explosiveness and the buoyance of the band versions, to me, the two acoustic versions are the keepers.
You're
because
right.
There's so much more emotional weight in those stripped down versions. You know, it's, and don't get me wrong, I love them because they're so different, but in my mind, it's those original acoustic versions that I didn't know were just him taking songs that hadn't, quote, yet been heard.
Well, I've got two more to throw at you, and I know the first one is really taking a chance because you detest the movie and the soundtrack and everything that it stands for. But I've got to say, the version of Good Day Sunshine on Broad Street is pretty damn good.
Okay, you know what?
I know, you used to like me, right?
It's not that, because you said if I ever did a remake of Good Give My Regards to Broad Street, you'd actually be sitting in the theater, so.
Yep.
Here's my problem with that and Eleanor Rigby and fucking around with, what was that, the opening line? To lead a better life, I need a love of my own.
Uh-huh.
My fist, your face, Paul.
Yeah. But the other
Don't
one.
Fuck with that.
Yeah. Well, and the other one I think you may actually be on board with, because I mentioned last week it came up, the bluesy version that Billy Squire did of The Stroke, which is from an album called 80s Hits Stripped. And on that album, it's got a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, Billy Idol does an acoustic version of Rebel Yell on there, which is weird. But there's a full band version of Our Lips Are Sealed by the Go-Go's with Jane Wiedlin on lead vocal.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's one of those that will make the hair on your arm stand up. It's amazing.
Can you hear them?
Can you
talk about
them?
Us?
10 lies. Well, that's no surprise. Can you see them?
See
right through them.
They
have no shield, no secrets to reveal.
Doesn't matter what they say. In the jealous games people play. Our lips are sealed.
So that one's well worth the price of admission. And the other thing that's on that album that was pretty cool is two songs that Colin Hay redid from the Men at Work era. He did Down Under, the acoustic version, and he did an acoustic version of Overkill that I think was on the Scrubs soundtrack that was also really well done. Not a whole lot different from the originals, but just a much cooler kind of take.
One, men and men made afraid of Kumbi. Okay, that's all I got to say about that. Number two, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking about the, you know, the Go-Go's and hearing Jane Wiedlin singing lead vocals on Our Lips Are Sealed, which obviously was very heartfelt because she wrote the song with her quote secret boyfriend Terry Hall. It reminded me that, you know, there's versions of Beatles songs sung by the Beatles, not who originally sang it. These were done during the Get Back, Let It Be sessions.
Okay.
You could make the argument that they were fucking around, but hearing McCartney singing She Said, and I'm So Tired, you know, Lennon half-assedly singing Yesterday, you know, George taking a shot at some of these songs, you know, I know it's kind of funny, but it is interesting. I mean, at least McCartney kind of fumbles his way pretty nicely into doing it. It's always an interesting thing, like, when you hear... I'll give you a good example. You know the song Pure and Easy by The Who, off of Who's Next?
Mm-hmm.
And how Daltrey's voice sounds so rich on that, but there's something touching about Townsend's version, which came out on Who Came First. Released roughly around the same time. You know, there's always an interesting different slant on certain things when you've got a different singer doing the song. And I don't look at Townsend's version as a demo either.
Right.
I just see it as being, you know, it's really there because Daltrey's is sung with a sort of romantic passion. Townsend's is definitely coming from a spiritual place. That to me is kind of a significant difference in the versions.
Cool. Well, we're going to have to revisit this one of these days because there's so much to mine, and given a little time to prep it, I bet we could come up with an album's worth of our own. But that's going to have to just about do it for this time around. And Rob Ross, again, the happiest of Thanksgivings, my man. Have a great one. Enjoy the food. And I'm sure we'll have no end of things to talk about on the next version of Radio City.
You too, my friend. Love to you and your family. Have a great rest of the week. Hope you had a chance to relax and wind out a bit. And to all our very loving listeners, we wish you all a very wonderful and joyful Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you soon.
You got it, brother. We'll see you.